Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Victory Garden Initiative invites you to attend their Food Leadership Certificate Program on January 28th, which equips emerging leaders in this field. Learn more at victorygardeninitiative.org/foodleader.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. Today's program features Dr. Renee James, who is professor of physics at Sam Houston State University in Texas. She earned a PhD in astronomy from the University of Texas at Austin. She also writes for Astronomy Magazine, which is based in Waukesha. And those of you who tune into the WGTD broadcast from Yerkes Observatory may also be a fans of Astronomy Magazine, and perhaps you've read her work. Dr. James's book, which is the topic of today's interview, is published by Johns Hopkins University Press in 2014, and it is called Science Unshackled: How Obscure, Abstract, Seemingly Useless Scientific Research Turned Out to Be the Basis of Modern Life, or for Modern Life. I invited her on the show today to discuss her book and some of its implications for science, for research policy decisions, and for the future of higher education, which is obviously a big issue in our state. So, Dr. James, welcome to Education Matters.
Thanks for having me on.
So the first question I have for you is, what inspired you to write this book?
Oh, this book goes back a long way, actually. It was 2011. Specifically, it was July 2011. And the United States Congress voted to cancel the funding for the James Webb Space Telescope. And many people may not have heard what the James Webb Space Telescope is, but in astronomical circles, it is the thing that is going to make Hubble Space Telescope look, you know, not so great. I mean, this is a massively impressive telescope that's going to be launched in 2018. And because it's so impressive, it also is really, really expensive. And it has technologies that when they plan the telescope, the technologies didn't exist, right? So they have to develop them. This takes more time. This makes things get more expensive. And eventually Congress just said, look, this thing's getting really expensive and we just want to not do that anymore. And so they just cut funding. Just one day, all of a sudden, boom, not doing this anymore. And they've reinstated it since then because there was such an outcry. But it was just such a punch in the gut. And then that exact same week was the very last space shuttle launch. Now, this doesn't seem particularly related, but, you know, the very first space shuttle went up when I was in sixth grade. And I thought, one of these days, I'm going to go watch a space shuttle launch, right? It's just going to happen. And 30 years came and went, and I never, ever got out to see a space shuttle launch. And I was kind of heartbroken because, you know, here's the last one. This is it. This is the last shuttle. This entire program's been canceled. And, I mean, I'm practically in tears, and I'm reading every news article about it so that I can see every quotation by every astronaut ever. And at the bottom of one of these news articles was this really cynical comment. What do they plan on doing up there anyway? Can they cure cancer? And I just thought, really? This is what you're thinking about the last space shuttle launch, is that it's totally pointless, it's totally useless, and if it's not going to be curing cancer, then there's no real reason for it. And so it really struck me that people don't understand what connections science has to the rest of their life sometimes. And a lot of times, you know, when they ask a question like, are they going to be able to cure cancer by going up in the space shuttle? You know, the answer might be, maybe. You don't know. You don't know what kinds of things you're going to find out when you're doing science. And so that really inspired me to write this book that connects things that seemed really, really pointless when the scientists were first asking the questions to things that are now stuff that we just basically can't live without.
Okay. Well, so again, trying to make the connection between what you're talking about to our particular situation. We had a senator from 1957 to 1989, Senator William Proxmire, who was famous for criticizing scientific funding, among other things, and gave out a monthly Golden Fleece Award, which often targeted spending on scientific research, especially from the National Science Foundation. And you mentioned him in the introduction to your book. So lay out your case for us, for all those people out there who might have applauded Senator Proxmire when he was doing this. why is the seemingly useless scientific research that Senator Proxmire targeted often, why is that sort of work important?
Well, the thing is, and I'd like to go back to J.J. Thomson, actually. This is the guy that discovered the electron, okay? Discovered the electron. And this was, you know, back in the late 1800s. And even at that stage of the game, scientists were so accustomed to hearing, what good is it, that Thomson would actually toast to the electron, may it never be of any use to anybody, right? And so that right there is just a really telling story, because this is the electron, right? I mean, we've got, you go to Target, there's an electronics aisle. Why? Because we figured out how to make use of this thing, and it's all over, right? But the thing is, when he is exploring this and discovering this electron, he has no idea what it's ever going to be used for. Scientists don't know what, if any, practical application is going to come out of their work, right? And so you wind up with things like discovering a fundamental particle of matter, and he doesn't know that it's ever going to turn into something that's going to be all around you. He's just exploring these questions. And that's the thing that Proxmire didn't quite understand, was that when you're asking a question, you're trying to find an answer to something. You know, as long as you communicate your answer to other scientists and to the public, then you never know who's going to pick that ball up and run with it, right? Mm. Proxmire was kind of famous for the Golden Fleece Award, because what he would do is he'd pick out titles of research projects, just titles. And scientists kind of occasionally give really quirky titles to things, which maybe they shouldn't, but, you know, they still do. And so one of these things, one of them that really stuck with me was the one called the Sex Life of the Screwworm Fly, right? And so Proxmire is looking at this title and going, okay, that's just creepy and gross. And why are we spending money on this? But it turns out it's this nasty little parasitic thing that gets into the wounds of things like cattle and will cause enormous devastation, lots of suffering on the part of the animal, but also kills these heads of cattle, and farmers, ranchers, they're losing all of these funds from, you know, these animals that they can't sell anymore. And it winds up being, it was like a $50,000 grant to understand the reproductive cycle of this particularly nasty parasite. And once we understood that, we could then like halt it. We could get in there and mess with this reproductive cycle so that they would not be a problem. But until you did that, you couldn't, right? Until you understood how they reproduced and became such a pest, you couldn't figure out how to control them. And once you got this, then you could save all of these billions of dollars. And it was that one in particular where Proxmire basically just kind of backpedaled and said, oh, okay, never mind. Just kidding, right? But at that point, you've got the seeds of distrust already sown, and all of the taxpayers are looking at this going, hey, yeah, that's right. These scientists are out there wasting money. And that damage, I think we're still seeing it. You know, for the past 40 years, we've had a lot of mistrust about what scientists are doing. Why is our tax money paying for this thing?
So the way that you organized your book is to trace five technologies that we all know now from their beginnings in obscure science to their current applications. And I just want to point out to listeners, if you do decide to pick up this book, Science Unshackled, which you can get on Amazon, by the way, it's very compelling. It's not long, and it's organized in a way that's really easy for a layperson to read. And I am not a scientist, so I just want to point this out right now. But which five events or technologies did you trace and choose, and why did you choose those five?
Hey, so the five that I picked up on that I wanted to look at were the development of GPS, the development of Wi-Fi, DNA sequencing, a painkiller that's called Prialt, and it's an extraordinarily potent painkiller, and an experimental cancer therapy that's called resonant nanoplasma theranostics. So those are my five. Mm-hmm. Now, with why I picked these particular ones, I wanted to do some things about, you know, familiar things, things that everybody realizes are ubiquitous, things like Wi-Fi and GPS. But I also wanted to incorporate some of the sort of lesser known but vital ones, like the DNA sequencing, the painkiller development. I mean, most people will never ever have to deal with the painkiller that was the result of a scientist's curiosity about cone snail venom. I wanted some examples of things that had been successful developments, but I also wanted to have a story that was unfinished. So the cancer therapy story, that actually stalled a few years ago due to underfunding. I originally had a much longer list. For instance, there was this parasitic fly that can find its host cricket and zero in on it, even though, as far as everybody understood about fly ears and the way those things are put together, there was just no way that they should be able to get the direction right. And so that particular finding could potentially change hearing aid technology. But again, that development was kind of stalled when I was working on the book. And so that chapter started and didn't finish. There were a number of other chapters that got started, but they were, you know, from start to finish, they were just much shorter. So what I wound up with was the five, because they wove a story through, in most cases, a few centuries. They crossed disciplines. They crossed geographical boundaries, and it showed basically how connected scientific research is to society all throughout, you know, the ages and across countries.
Okay. Well, we're going to explore one of those topics in depth, that of the development of something most of us use every day, Wi-Fi or wireless internet access. But first, I just want to reintroduce you. This is Education Matters on WGTD HD 91.1 FM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and I am interviewing Dr. Renee James about her book, Science Unshackled, How Obscure, Abstract, Seemingly Useless Scientific Research Turned Out to Be the Basis for Modern Life. If you're just joining us and would like to hear the earlier part of the interview, remember to access our webpage at WGTD.org, where this program will be archived early next week. You may also join us on the WGTD Education Matters Facebook page, where you can discuss this program with the hosts and fellow listeners. So let's discuss the development of our understanding that led to Wi-Fi. First, let's list some of the ways our ability to access data in digital form has influenced modern life. You start this section, which is entitled Finding a Hotspot, by trying to get your readers to imagine what it might be like to be suffering a heart attack in the area, while biking, actually, in the story that you tell, near the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. Is this a true story, or is this just sort of an imagined story of what could happen?
Actually, all the stories in the introductory parts of the chapters are true. Okay, they four of them came straight out of news stories that I dug up when I was trying to do the research for this. One of them was adapted from somebody's blog about suffering from chronic regional pain syndrome. But, you know, the stories are, you know, initially true, but I modified them so that you could pull the reader into imagining what it would be like to be in those situations, give it a little bit more personal relevance. And again, the Wi-Fi section does start with somebody suffering a heart attack near the Mayo Clinic. And when that happened, there had just been an initiative to have Wi-Fi in that entire area. And so fortunately, because they're near the Mayo Clinic, there was not a doctor. You know, there was a doctor not far away. And this person was able to pretty much instantaneously pull up the medical records for the person that was suffering the heart attack and realize, hey, this is a lot more serious than it might seem, and we need to get this going. And it turns out that if the patient had simply gone to the emergency room, most likely it would have taken too much time to diagnose the problem. They would have misdiagnosed the issue at first, and there's a very good chance that patient would have died were it not for the fact that there was Wi-Fi available in this gym locker room, basically.
And then the story has a happy ending, right?
Yeah. The patient lived and then, you know, celebrated with the doctor and all the people that helped them out just a couple of days after the heart attack.
Okay, so this is a real story. What I wonder is, let's maybe list some other uses for Wi-Fi in modern life. You know, we all love our mobile phones now and sharing funny cat videos, but what are some ways that Wi-Fi is used that maybe the general public doesn't even realize?
Other than sharing funny cat videos?
Yeah, I mean, that's important, but...
Is that... Okay, I guess there are other things. Well, I mean, for one, I'm actually using it right now.
Right.
To do this with you, right?
I mean, yes.
But, I mean, you can look at ways that it's revolutionized education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to have Wi-Fi in so many places, you can now take classes without being physically present. And you could sort of do that before, but now you can do it in, you know, a much more efficient fashion and more in real time. I can't even begin to fathom the amount of money that I've spent because I can use Wi-Fi to do transactions,
mm-hmm.
right? The commerce that's facilitated by Wi-Fi is, you can't, I mean, I imagine somebody could put a price tag on it, but, you know, these are really big numbers that we're talking about.
Okay, so I think we've established that Wi-Fi is something that most of us use frequently, and it's pretty important to our modern lives. But how did we get here? So let's walk through the short chapters included in this section. Generally speaking, the book is organized so that you tell us sort of stories about different scientists and how their work ends up connecting to the next scientist's work, even if it's not obvious it's going to do that. So you trace the development of Wi-Fi back to 1784 and someone named Parson John Mitchell. Who is he and how does it proceed from there?
So Mitchell was actually the very first person to suggest that something that we now call a black hole might exist. Okay, so this is the first instance of somebody saying, oh, hey, there's a possibility that you could have something that has such strong gravity that even light couldn't escape, right? At that point, it was just kind of a mathematical curiosity, but as our scientific understanding developed, it became pretty clear that these things were potentially real. I mean, they still didn't have any evidence for them, but it wasn't contradicting our understanding of things in the universe. And then by the time you get to the 1970s, right, we've gone from 1784 to the 1970s, astronomers had gathered enough evidence from the rest of the universe to be convinced that, yeah, these things that were once called gravitationally completely collapsed objects, which would never have made a Disney movie title, but these black holes could be leftovers from the lives of really massive stars. And the neat thing about black holes is that they're simple, sort of, cosmically speaking, and that's that the more massive they are, the bigger their sphere of influence is, and so the less massive they are, the smaller their sphere of influence is. And this is something that didn't become an issue until much, much later, but in another thread, you've got people trying to understand the entire universe, right? You've got Mitchell who says, oh, hey, there might be these things that are really, really strongly gravitating objects. And then you've got other people that are making observations about the universe. And then you get to about the 1920s and you get a guy named Edwin Hubble. And he makes observations of distant galaxies, and it indicates, hey, the universe seems to be expanding. Okay, and if the universe is expanding now, if you just rewind the videotape and watch it backwards, then you've got a universe that's shrinking, and way back when, it would have been much, much smaller, much, much denser, had a very distinct origin in time, not so much in space, but in time. And, you know, at this point, you're thinking, this isn't really connected to the Wi-Fi thing too much, right? Okay. And right. So then you've got another unrelated thread, seemingly, and that's in the 70s. Stephen Hawking says black holes might eventually give up some of that mass that they're hanging on to, okay? Because there are these very bizarre rules about things on very, very tiny scales that don't apply to you and me. But once you get to little bitty tiny scales, subatomic size scales, then they start applying there. And most black hole people went, yes, that's great, but black holes left over by massive stars are not tiny thing. I mean, they're tiny for what they've got in them, but they're not tiny. They're kilometers wide. And then the story just gets weirder from there.
So Stephen Hawking is someone that most of us would have heard of, and probably Hubble. So Stephen Hawking has made the point that black holes might not be large. Is that what I'm understanding correctly? That they might be tiny?
Yeah, that they could potentially be tiny. Because if you take the idea that the entire universe started out at some point in time and it was much, much, much smaller and much, much, much denser than it is now, then there was nothing to keep material from gathering together in little tiny pockets as the universe was starting out as black holes back then. You know, these are things that would be called primordial black holes, and they would not have the size of a black hole that's left over from a massive star going kablooey. So you could have these pockets of matter that were really, really tiny. I mean, like atom size tiny, had the mass of a mountain crammed into them. And now we're talking about a place that's small enough where those really bizarre rules of things going on those teeny tiny scales start to matter. And what Stephen Hawking realized is that stuff that is inside the black hole could find itself outside the black hole and escape. And that would make your black hole a little less massive, which means it's technically a little smaller, which means it's easier for something that's inside the black hole to find itself on the outside of the black hole, and that makes your black hole even smaller. And so what you wind up having is this thing called Hawking radiation, and it causes the evaporation of your black hole. And so Hawking basically says, hey, there's a possibility that way back in the early universe, there were these teeny tiny black holes. And these teeny tiny black holes, if you give them long enough, which happens to be about the current age of the universe, should be evaporating all around us. Maybe. We don't know. You know, we're just kind of, it's a theoretical object that might or might not exist. But then the astronomers are like, oh, that's wicked cool. I want to go find an exploding black hole. And you would think that finding something like that that's spewing out that much energy would be a breeze. But it's not as easy as it sounds. And it turns out that one of the easiest ways that you could try to find these things is to use radio waves. And so they developed an idea of the exact type of signal you would get as the energy goes racing away from this exploding black hole, plowing through the stuff that's in the universe, and eventually getting to us. So they knew exactly what the signal would look like from the death of a thing that might or might not exist, and if it does exist, it might or might not ever die.
So the astronomers are trying to figure out a way to identify if this thing that Stephen Hawking has theorized is really exists.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Right. And this still seems like really, really far away from anything that you and I would ever care about, except, wow, that would be kind of cool. Stephen Hawking would get his Nobel Prize, and that would be great. The thing is, if you're working at a radio telescope, and a radio telescope is huge, right? They're trying to pick up very, very, very faint signals from across the universe in radio waves, which is, most people think of radio waves and they think, you know, hey, that's sound, right? But no, it's a type of light. To pick it up and to really unravel the signal, you typically need an extraordinarily large dish to try to pick this stuff up. But on top of that, this signal of a black hole exploding is going to give you a lot of different frequencies. Okay? And it's going to be something that they call a down chirp. And so it goes like, pew, like that, wow. Except with radio waves.
Mm-hmm.
Or like if you've ever heard a hawk, the call of a hawk, that it's the same kind of thing. It starts at a high frequency and goes down to a low frequency. So they're expecting this. And then this information is going through trillions upon trillions of miles of stuff in the universe, and that's messing with it. And so here we are. We've got our humble little radio telescopes. We're trying to figure out how we're going to disentangle a signal of a thing that might or might not be happening somewhere in the universe. And so that requires a bit of engineering. In the 1970s, the people that decided that they were going to go out and try to find exploding black holes involved an engineer whose name was John O'Sullivan. And yeah, he got on this problem. A few of the attempts at trying to figure out how you're going to pull out a signal, a specific signal like this, were just almost comical. You know, if you've ever seen a Rube Goldberg kind of project, then it's kind of like that. You know, well, we could do a thing that does this, and then we could record it this way. And, you know, after a while, they realized this is ridiculous. You know, we're looking at miles and miles of readout. There's got to be a better way to do this. And so Sullivan goes back to the drawing board, comes up with an idea for a thing that could reconstruct a signal that has gone through so much distortion on its way to us.
You've got Hawking proposing that these tiny black holes might exist, but astronomers were interested in trying to actually verify their existence, and there was no clear way to measure that. So there were a whole lot of people working on this problem trying different ways to do so. And John O'Sullivan is the one who figured it out, and you're going to tell us how.
He's basically the one that figured out how you would engineer a thing to take a bunch of radio signals that have gone through different pathways and interfered with each other and interfered with other things. Okay, and that really was the upshot of the entire problem. You've got this signal that's been trucking across the universe. It has had a whole fleet of things interfering with it, but you want to try to tease out this one particular signal. And so what he did was he engineered a device to be able to do that. Now, this is the exact problem that we run into if we're going to try to, for instance, wirelessly connect my computer with somebody else's, is that, you know, you can send out signals, but the room's got chairs, the walls have metal beams, there are all these other things that are going to mess with the signal as it's trying to get from here to the next room over. Okay, but if you've already got a thing that can reduce that interference and help you pull out the signal that you want, then you've solved the problem, right? You've solved the problem before anybody even realizes it's a problem that you need to solve.
Right. So before there was Wi-Fi, we all had wired connections.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually remember my older brother would work over the summers to pull cables for computers through, you know, the drop ceilings. Mm-hmm. Of office buildings,
I
so
remember,
that you could connect. Oh my gosh, it was a nightmare.
Or trying to wire a school so that the children could, you know, use the internet on computers. That was a huge undertaking in the late 90s, I remember very clearly.
Yeah, so, heaven forbid you ever wanted to move your computers.
Right, then, yeah, so you were sort of anchored to whatever the cable was at the time. So by trying to find the black holes, these astronomers just basically figured out a way to identify signals that were going not through matter in space, but matter in our homes and in our workplaces?
Yeah, basically. What? Yeah, I mean, the thinking that they had to use to solve that problem was the exact thinking that they had to use to solve the problem of trying to wirelessly connect computers. Hmm. You know, but they had already solved that problem. And so when it became obvious that this is something that you could use in industry, O'Sullivan actually started up his own, with a number of other people, a communications sort of startup company that created this. And the very first time that they ever demonstrated wireless interface between the computers, and it had just an incredible speed. I mean, I remember, again, aging myself, way back in, you know, like the 80s and 90s, you would hook up to a modem, right? Mm-hmm. If you wanted to talk to a computer somewhere else, and it would kind of creep along at this really ponderously slow rate, and we would play these text-based games, and, you know, graphics were just not ever going to happen. And then he introduces this at a convention. Says, hey, look at this. And it was, you know, almost 1,000 times faster than anything else that anybody had used.
Mm-hmm. So they figured this out. They made it so that the thing that they were trying to find actually turned out to be a technology that we could use to have Wi-Fi in our homes and our workplaces and elsewhere. The last chapter of this section is called Anatomy of a Successful Failure. So tell us a little about that particular sort of summary chapter, and then how this title might be applied in other areas of science as well.
Right. I mean, even now, nobody has detected exploding black holes. It just has not ever. They've been looking for 40 years. They've never found an unambiguous signal that says, hey, yes, a black hole, a primordial black hole has evaporated. There hasn't been a problem with any of the theory. They haven't looked at it and said, well, you know, obviously we wouldn't expect them. It's just a matter we have never detected them. So what these guys originally set out to do back in the 70s never happened, right? As a scientific story, they didn't discover the thing that they tried to discover, right? And yet what they did do was something that was never on their radar. And that was basically to change everybody's life. Because if you want to get down to it, the reason that they were pursuing this project was it just sounded really cool. You know, black holes exploding? Cool. And then somebody said, ooh, I bet you know what? If they did that, this is the type of signal that we would get from it. And they said, oh, that's great. We can look for that signal. Oh, man, the universe is filled with stuff. We're going to have to really work hard to pick this signal out. And then they have to engineer a thing to try to get this signal out. And then they wind up changing our lives, right, because of it. But, you know, scientifically speaking, this was a failure. They never found what they were looking for, and nobody has since then.
Hmm. So I guess it really illustrates what you're suggesting, both in the title of the book and in the title of this chapter, which is a lot of times science is done to try to solve one problem, and it fails. But then it ends up solving another problem, which makes it successful.
Right. And the thing is, in that respect, science is never actually a failure. I mean, even a negative answer is a good answer. And there's a huge push to report negative results so that people don't keep replicating the same thing. I mean, these days, if you want to write a scientific journal article, then typically the idea is you write about, you know, something unusual that you found or something that you succeeded in doing, and not, you know, we looked at 100,000 of these things and still didn't find what we were looking for. But I mean, you know, in science, you're asking these fundamental questions, and unlike what you see in a lot of science fairs, you don't know what the answer is going to be. You go out and try to find it. And if the answer is no, then that's still a good, valid sort of scientific answer to get. It's just that it's typically looked on as being, you know, a failure of an answer, right?
Mm-hmm. Let me just stop to reintroduce again. This is Education Matters on WGTD HD 91.1 FM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and I'm interviewing Dr. Renee James about her book, Science Unshackled, How Obscure, Abstract, and Seemingly Useless Scientific Research Turned Out to Be the Basis for Modern Life. She just explained to us how Wi-Fi came from a search for tiny microscopic black holes that were a part of a theory developed by Stephen Hawking. If you're just joining us and would like to hear the earlier part of the interview, remember to access our webpage at WGTD.org, where this program will be archived. You may also join us on WGTD Education Matters Facebook page, where you can discuss this program with hosts and fellow listeners. So another one of the sections of your book is titled Pick Your Poison. And it talks about an unlikely source for the treatment of chronic pain, the cone snail, cone like ice cream cone, C-O-N-E, and its venom. So tell us that story. We'll have to be a little more brief because we're running out of time, but someone was just really curious about this snail. That's how the whole thing started, yes?
Yeah, basically, Toto Oliveira grew up in the Philippines, and when he was a child, he just thought that these shells on the beach were really, really cool. He grows up, gets advanced degrees, comes over to the United States. He's got, his scientific program working. But then he feels a need to contribute to the scientific community back in the Philippines. So he goes back there, and he has, basically no competitive lab, nothing that's going to really compete with, the higher end stuff. And he goes back to his childhood curiosity, which is cone snails. And these are things that they've got these weird little harpoons in them, and you reach and grab one of these snails in the sea, and it will harpoon you and inject you with some nasty venom and kill you pretty quickly. He was just thinking, how is it that this tiny little thing can kill people? So he wanted to isolate that venom and figure out what the components of it were. And he did that, actually, in very short order. He found out that it was basically the same components in a pufferfish and cobra venom. So basically, you got the two deadly venoms that are coming together in one little tiny package, and they'll take you out in an extremely unpleasant fashion. But then, here's one of the things that I love about the story. He had a number of students that were working with him, and one of them just happened to ask, well, what happens if we take this venom, this particular component of this venom, and instead of it injecting it here in our mice, what if we inject it here instead? And Oliveira's response was essentially, well, that just seems like a totally pointless question, but, this is education. This is science. This is the way this works. This is a university. The students don't necessarily always ask really great questions, but when they're asking questions and there's an easy way to find out the answer, you let them go, right? This is how you explore how science is done. And it turned out that the answer wasn't anything like what they expected. If they took different components of the cone snail venom, it would do very, very different things to the mice, depending on where you injected it in their nervous system. Okay, and one thing in particular they found would actually completely block the electrical signal of pain trying to get to the brain. Okay, not sort of dull the pain or deaden or anything. It would block that signal. It was a basic physical thing going on at the atomic level, molecular level. And it was at that point that they realized, hey, this is a really important finding that we've got. And it's all because you have this kid that was interested in pretty shells, back when he was seven.
And then it turns out that there is a chronic pain disease that this particular treatment was able to solve. And there's even an anecdote in the book about someone who, was pretty young and was stricken by this disease, and then was able to, through this research, which, as you said, just originated with pretty shells, was able to sort of solve that problem and go on to become a productive member of society. Is that right?
Right, yeah. I mean, there's a number of illnesses that will cause, incredibly debilitating chronic pain. cancer being one of them, right? How is your interest in cone snails ever going to help anybody? Is it going to cure cancer? Well, no, but it might make it less painful. And the example that I gave in the book was the chronic regional pain syndrome. And it's something that nobody really understands where it comes from, but apparently it is basically like the pain of childbirth all over your body 24/7.
Ooh.
And it has a nickname. It's called the suicide disease.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason for that. But this finding, from the cone snail venom is something that, it's not something that you just go to your doctor and say, hey, can I have some Prialt, which is short for primary alternative to morphine, because the laundry list of side effects is pretty huge. But when you've reached the end of your tether, right, this is the type of thing that you get, and it's something that's it gets injected directly into the spinal column.
Mm-hmm.
So you need a pump. It's not, you don't just take a little pill.
Right.
But it does make it so that a life that was not really going so well, right, is suddenly something that you can manage.
So that's another one of the stories. I would encourage listeners to pursue this and go and see how GPS, how DNA sequencing developed. And then also, as your last chapter is, it's sort of the beginning stages of a new treatment for cancer, but maybe not totally finished at that point. What is a final thought that you would like listeners to take from our discussion besides to buy and read your book, which, again, is called Science Unshackled? The author is Renee James. But what do we need to know about the development of science and technology, and how much of this is based in public universities and research funding?
Well, most of this stuff actually began with some nature of public funding. Now, once it reaches the point where you've got a product, then a lot of times you will break out into either a startup company or, with a pharmaceutical company or something like that. But, as long as you're just exploring these questions, for the most part, this is stuff that was funded in public universities or by things like the National Science Foundation or by other countries' versions of the National Science Foundation, like Australia's CSIRO was one of the big funders for the attempt to find exploding black holes. And actually, that particular organization is pulling in millions of royalties for Wi-Fi at this point.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes it does end up becoming a viable and profitable thing, but we never know when it first starts.
Right, you don't know. And that's the thing. I mean, I think that comes back to those words of J.J. Thomson: to the electron, may it never be of any use to anybody. This is a Nobel Prize winning physicist. He's not an idiot. And he understands something about the fundamental workings of the atom that nobody has ever understood before. And yet, even then, he didn't understand how it could ever be used. Right. And so scientists are not so good at figuring out the ultimate value of their research. They ask questions, they explore the questions. And the thing is, they need to be able to communicate what they're finding to other scientists or to engineers or in some cases to like medical field practitioners. Yeah. And it's this continual crosstalk between things that will allow for the creativity to take these things and apply them to something that can make a difference.
Mm. So maybe Senator Proxmire wasn't so, let's say, practical, even though he seemed to think he was, by trying to point out things that sounded too obscure to be useful.
Right, and it's the thing of trying to demonstrate to your voters, hey, I'm trying to save you money. But I mean, in the long run, science is phenomenally inexpensive. It really is. We don't, as a country, pay all that much for science. It's in the neighborhood of $70 billion per year for the entirety of science research. Okay? And that's peanuts compared to the $3 trillion or so that's the United States budget. But the returns on it, are huge. As a whole, science pays for itself and then some.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, one of the things that people need to understand is that even if this question doesn't seem particularly important. It's connected to a much bigger picture. And, you know, our economy, everything that we do is just a big ecosystem. And when you start pulling back on some of those levels, you don't know what it's going to affect.
Okay. Well, I guess on that note, I would just like to say again, this is Education Matters.